going on a low, I've been taking my time. I feel like I'm out of my mind. It feel like my life ain't mine. I've been on the low, I've been taking my time.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Project Mayday. These are your hosts, F and G, and today we have someone very special. His name is Tony Brooks. He is a local legend out of Sacramento, California, and which makes him a local legend is he started off at Oakmont, and he made his way to the largest rescue and recovery mission since Vietnam, where he actually rescued Marcus Luttrell, him and his team. Rescued Marcus Luttrell, and you might know Marcus Luttrell from the movie back in 2014 that was starred by Mark Wahlberg. And we'll hear all about that operation and the mental aspect that goes into rescuing somebody and the bodies of those fallen soldiers. So, Dr. Brooks, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, you went to my rival high school. I have a little bit of animosity towards that school, but we'll still keep you on.
Sounds good. I didn't get into the rivalries too much when I was in high school, so it's okay.
But you played basketball, and G played basketball as well.
Nope.
Correct.
Yes. Yep. If you read the book, he talks about the infamous layup.
Yeah.
That's supposed to turn into
the
game.
And the book Zeph is referring to is No Man Left Behind, and it is a book that Dr. Brooks is working on that's going to be out in August.
Awesome.
And so that'll be available, and we'll actually put a link down below for that book. So we have to get our signed copies, right?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So let's get into it, Dr. Brooks. Go ahead, Zeph. What do you got?
So, Dr. Brooks, why don't we start about your upbringings, sports you played, high school you went to. We kind of already brought that up, but people want to know about you and in the beginning. How did it all start out?
Pretty normal beginnings, right? I grew up in a middle-class town, Roseville, California. I played all the sports growing up, baseball, soccer, football, basketball. I played it all. And it's a great place to grow up. What can I say? It was not as big as it is now. It's probably about a tenth of the size, I think.
Yeah.
But it was a great place to grow up. And, you know, everyone got along. Never really had any big issues, either at school or in sports. You know, pretty middle class, middle of the road lifestyle. I was a nerd. What can I say? I did really well in school, and that was mostly my focus. Even though I love sports, I excelled in the classroom. That was kind of my thing.
Gotcha. You say nerd and whatnot. And I know you go into that in your book a lot. You make a lot of references to that. Why did you believe that, or what was your take on a nerd? You know, when you were growing up,
analytical. That's how he puts it. Analytical.
Yeah, I would say I was very analytical. I was passionate about doing everything well. I didn't like losing. I didn't like, and I talk about that in the book also, how I would whine when I would, you know, strike out in baseball and cry, and I was very emotional. That's because I wanted to win, and I always wanted to do well. And I think that translated into the classroom, which I call a nerd, but it really was just someone who was passionate.
Mm. And so let's take that passion into, you know, you graduated, your senior year was 2001, and
correct,
you know, that's 9/11, you know, it hits dear to us. However, not at the time, because I was in fifth grade at the time. I might be aging you a little bit, but I was in fifth grade at the time. And
I was in high school.
Yeah. So I know my experience was a lot different in being, you know, Indian and dealing with that, all that bullying going on with that. How was it for you? I know in the book, you know, you say that was like a core decision of you going into the military. So go with your thought process on, you know, when you saw those towers and how you came about to going into the Army.
Yeah. So in 2001, I graduated high school in June, and then I went off to the University of Arizona in Tucson. And what a beautiful place that is, first of all. Second, You know, it was my first or second week. I can't remember exactly what week it was in school, because I don't remember when we started, but it was near the beginning of the semester. And I was always up early because I like to go to the gym before class. And I had the TV on. And the thing I remember most, obviously the towers on fire was a big deal. I think everyone had a little knot in their stomach when they saw it the first time. But the one thing I remember that really stuck out was I remember seeing someone, like a little speck, coming down and falling. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment that instantly everything changed. It went from, oh my gosh, it's a tragedy, to, oh my God, I think we might be at war. Wow. And little did I know that, yeah, we were slowly, we were going to war less than a month later.
Yeah.
And I pretty much knew at that moment that I had to do something. I didn't know what it was. I actually had no inkling of joining the military at the time. But it wasn't long before I called my dad and said, hey, Dad, I think I want to join the military. And he basically paused, and there was a lot of silence on the line. Like, what? You want to do what? You want to leave school, like, right now? And yeah, I do.
So with that, you know, you had called your dad and told him that. However, there was a brief, there was a moment in time where he said, you know, think about it. And there was a time, you know, that time lapse of you thinking about your decision, then you ultimately being, okay, yeah, this is what I want to do. So in that time frame that he gave you, like, hey, son, you know, think about it a little bit. What was that inner dialogue like? Because I know, you know, you know, in the book, you're a smart guy. You know, you're doing all this. You're in all these classes. However, there's a different calling for you, and you recognized it. However, you didn't act on it until something happened, and you know, it was 9/11. So, talk about that inner dialogue a little bit.
Yeah. So, obviously, I wanted to do something. I didn't quite know what it was, and my dad, being very much like myself, said, you know what? You can't rush to judgment on things like this. You have a life to live, and you don't want to act emotionally, basically.
Yeah.
You can be emotional, but you don't want to act emotional. And so he convinced me to finish out my first year of college before making the decision. So I finished out my first year, and I was not doing well. I was not focused on school. I knew I shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And then, so after I finished that first year, I actually went back to start my second year, and didn't even finish the semester before I said, I'm coming home, joining the military. And that was it. It was my beginning of my sophomore year. I stopped after a month of classes, drove home, enlisted in the Army. And a lot of that was Pat Tillman, to be honest. I think he was a big figure in Arizona.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was someone I looked up to. You know, we had, I don't know if you remember the movies that came out at the time, but Black Hawk Down came out right after 9/11, actually.
Mm.
And that was a very emotional for me, watching that movie in the theaters. I think was another like planting of the seed, so to speak. Mm. But yeah, the next year I left, went home, enlisted. And because I was so stubborn and I wanted to be an airborne ranger, the contract wouldn't start for a few more months. So I got to did some community college right at Sierra College, actually. Oh. Did one semester there before I went into the Army.
Zeph's wife is actually a professor there.
That's right.
All right.
So
ironically, that semester, you know, I got straight A's after floundering at University of Arizona. I found my, you know, I found my passion to go into the military. And next thing I know, I'm getting straight A's again. It's amazing what your mind can do if it's focused, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So now, you know, you're going into boot camp. So where did you go into boot camp, you know, after you enlisted? Give us that little bit.
Yeah, so all infantry soldiers go through the same place. They go to Fort Benning, Georgia. And I went there in the February of 2004 is when I started. So it was a year after leaving Arizona, basically almost a full year. And then Yeah, you go to Fort Benning, Georgia, you do infantry and your basic training together. And then after that, you do airborne school. And then if you pass airborne school, then you go to what's called Ranger Indoctrination Program. And that's essentially weeding people out. They put you through the most rigorous mental and physical month of your life and give you every opportunity to quit. That's ultimately their goal.
It's funny. It's very poetically, poetic justice, where you said it's Ranger Indoctrination School, and then the abbreviation for it, what was that?
RIP. Yeah. RIP.
Yeah. Wow.
Trust me, it's not lost on anyone. They all chuckled when they would tell us they're going to RIP.
Yeah.
So, being, a nerd, as you call it, and, growing up, how you grew up, what was the burning desire to be a Ranger? Where did that come from? Was it to be a part of, because you that competitive edge? Like, where did that come from?
I think it was desire to be the best. I think that was a big part of it. Growing up, my brother actually was a big military buff, and he always told me that he was going to be a Ranger someday. So that was probably the initial seed that was planted. Like, he knew everything about Rangers, and he was always telling me. He was very into it. And from there, it was Black Hawk Down, Pat Tillman. It's like everything just lined up, and that's where I needed to be.
Gotcha.
So,
okay. So now we're getting to, you're an Army Ranger, and you get your first mission. And this mission here is a doozy, to say the least.
Yeah.
And like I said, most of you all have seen the movie in 2014 where, Marcus Luttrell was the only survivor, lone survivor, in a mission to, to scope out a village to find a certain target. And they were they were surrounded by Taliban troops. And basically, he was the only one that survived. So, Dr. Brooks here was part of that team that went to go get Marcus Luttrell and then also recover the bodies of the 16 other Navy SEALs plus, so 19, Mike Murphy, Axelson, and Danny Dietz. So please go into that mission and
from the start. Ironically, I had 6 months of training at my Ranger Battalion before leading up to this deployment. So I had a full training cycle. And for Rangers, that's 6 months, because every 6 months they deploy, basically. They have since 2001. And so I knew 6 months after getting there that I was probably going to be deployed overseas. And it turns out we were sent to Bagram, Afghanistan. And it was probably the slowest, most boring deployment of Ranger history. We were working out a lot. We were training every day, and the war had changed at that time. It was a war that was more winning the hearts and minds versus fighting. And Rangers are not built for winning hearts and minds. They're fighters, right?
Yeah.
So we were actually not busy, and one day we got the call. After being on what we call combat search and rescue, we had been on it for less than 2 weeks, and we got the call that there was a Chinook that was shot down. That's the first thing we heard, and it was a little surreal for us. We didn't really know, what that meant. Was that our guys on the Chinook? Was that someone else? We don't know. Come to find out, it was another special operations unit, Navy SEALs, as we found out, and happens to be one of the birds that we trained on only weeks before. And our job was to bring all those guys home. We had basically no intel other than helicopter shot down and we need to go get them. And that was it. And we were quickly putting on our gear and hopping on the next Chinook. So we were going on the same helicopter that was just shot down, which was a little mind-numbing, I would say. All of us were on that bird thinking, how did this big thing get shot down?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen one, but they're bigger than a school bus, much bigger. Like, a school bus can almost park inside of the thing.
Wow.
So one of those things flying around and you got 20 to 30 guys in there, you know that it just got real.
Yeah.
Real quick.
You expressed in the book, there was a lot of frustration prior to you guys actually getting on and deploying to the site. What was the frustration about exactly?
Yeah, we were extremely frustrated because, as you would imagine, the military did not want to lose any more men or any more equipment. They just lost a whole helicopter, which is millions of dollars, plus the men on board. You can't quantify that one, but not good. So they were very hesitant to put us near that site. I'm sure someone who's listening will probably be familiar with another Chinook being shot down. It was called Roberts Ridge a few years prior to this mission. And in that mission, Rangers came in and that bird was also hit. So, you know, this wasn't the first rodeo. Let's put it, and so they were very, very hesitant to put guys on the crash site. So it took some time and we were very frustrated because we wanted to help our guys, you know.
Yeah.
As you guys know, you know, being in on the front line, you number one is the guys to your right and left.
Yeah.
That's your priority. And then the guys that you're going to help, or the women, it doesn't matter who it is. But that's your priority. That's it. That's all that matters in the world at that time. So we were extremely frustrated that we couldn't get to them. And it took us 24 hours.
And you guys were training with, it was with that exact plane, right? That exact helicopter, right? With that crew. And you guys weren't just training on how to recover or how to rescue, but also how to dismantle and destroy parts of specific parts of the helicopter. That way, what the intel can't get to the enemy forces and eventually use that against us, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it was weeks prior to this incident. We were training specifically for this thing happening. So, you know, pretty crazy to think about the chances that we have never trained on this before. This was a relatively not a common mission for Rangers. But at the time, they were tasking us out with basically everything that they could because the 75th Ranger Regiment is a great asset to our military and we weren't being used for it very much at the time. So that was a newer mission for us. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we never trained on it prior, but we spent, you know, a few days learning how to dismantle the helicopter, get rid of all sensitive equipment, and of course help all of our guys.
Yeah,
we were ready.
You were training with tools like me and G use, the jaws of life, right? To cut open the helicopters and get to where you got to get to, yeah.
Yeah, and where this crash happened was pretty frustrating too because it was so far up in the mountains that a lot of that equipment we couldn't bring. We had to hike it in, and there's only so many of us. So you can imagine trying to carry the jaws.
No.
That would be awful.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Along with all your ammunition and guns.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, so you speak about, you know, you can see this beam of light, which is the crash site when you're coming in. And then you get boots on the ground and you're walking up and you can smell the fuel burning. You can smell the site. And one thing that you say in the book is you're looking off to your right and you see this, you know, woods, and you just wonder if there's Taliban in those woods. And walk us through that, you know, just walking up to the crash site and knowing that you might be ambushed right now because it's a beacon. I mean, the helicopter is a beacon right now.
Yeah, I fully expected to be ambushed, to be honest. And I think all of us did. You know, if you look at history, anytime there's a helicopter crash or any event that they know that is going to bring troops, they're usually ready.
Yeah.
We fully expected at any moment, you know, it was going to erupt. Thankfully, we made it to the crash site without that happening. We did have a few scares on the way, but it was more so us trying to battle the terrain than anything.
No.
You know, the enemy was, it was in the back of our mind, but the terrain was brutal. And that's what really was top of mind for all that. Yeah. But yeah, seeing and smelling the crash site was something I'll never forget. It's something that will always stick with you.
It's also very well, the way it's described throughout the book, the terrain, like, that's not really anything that you take into mind when you think of war. And it plays such a huge, huge part in it. The mountains, the loose rocks that are constantly talked about. Even just when you were rappelling in, like, that part of the book had my heart racing, just like rappelling down and not being able to see anything through the thick fog. And you know, your radio operator, he had someone laying on top of him, and because he was like on his back, and you guys were just rappelling down, you couldn't even see the floor, right? You're just rappelling down into nothingness, not even knowing if the end of the rope even hit the ground.
Yeah, that was, I mean, we were trained so well on that. I'll admit, I was like a robot. I was going down that rope no matter what.
Yeah.
There's nothing that was going to stop me. And, you know, I, as I'm going down, I'm just thinking, why have I not hit the ground yet?
Yeah.
My hands were heating up. Because when you slide down these ropes, you're just gripping it. And you got leather gloves on. They only protect you so much. And I could feel them warming up. And
Where was the end of the rope?
I was waiting, and I found the end, and it was the earth knocking me down.
So that was your first like big mission after you became a Army Ranger. Like, were you in the mindset of, oh, I'm doing it? Like, how, you know, we get our first fire and we're like, oh, I'm in it, I'm doing it. Like, were you thinking that, or what was going on?
Maybe. I think, I mean, there was a lot of stuff going through my mind. I knew this was a big deal, just by looking at some of the leaders around me who have been there and done it hundreds of times. They were acting different than I've ever seen them. So instantly that changes your whole psyche, right? Mm-hmm. If you had your leaders in front of you acting a certain way that they've never acted before, you know to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So thankfully they kept their cool, because I probably would have lost it if not.
Well, glad you didn't. So let's go into, you know, people have seen the movie and we want to give them a different perspective. The perspective of getting, you know, Marcus and getting and retrieving the bodies and whatnot of those SEALs. Go into the mental aspect of you know, you talk about it in your book about scraping someone off of a tree, you know, and scraping bodies off of the hillside there.
Breaking bones to put them inside the bags in order to get them sent back home.
Yeah. So if you can, you know, put yourself back in that mind state and describe what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's the most awful thing of war, right? You don't ever expect to see anything other than the enemy in that kind of state. And so I don't think any of us were prepared. And I think most of us, I think we were just going through the motions, get our guys home, get them home. It wasn't until right after that it kind of really hit us all. And I think, most of us were fine at the time, but I think we did what we always do. We tell, you know, bad jokes. It's mostly just joking around that you probably wouldn't do in normal life, but when you're stressed out, that off humor is something that keeps the mood relatively sane.
Yeah, you said in your book, you're like, like you just said, we make off jokes and we laugh in the heat of something terrible. But you also said, you know, what's the other option? We cry? So it's like, yeah, we make jokes and it sounds terrible to, you know, civilians,
right?
People who aren't living this life. You know, it's kind of like, it's the same thing at the firehouse, and I'm sure it's the same thing, police and hospitals and things like that. It's like, what is the other option? You know, you break down and cry, like that's not going to help us complete our task, what we need to get done.
Yeah, I'd say there's a time for crying, right?
Yeah.
And I would 100% say that everyone should cry. And that was one of my weaknesses, was it took me years to cry about it. It took me years. It was always the off humor and the deflection, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But, you can't do it in the moment. If you do it in the moment, you're not going to finish the mission.
Exactly.
So you've got to deflect. You've got to do something to take your mind off of the horror that you just witnessed or just, you know, participated in.
Yeah, you say it so elegantly in your book. You say, you know, real men cry, real men feel emotions, but soldiers can't. Because in the moment you're being a soldier, you got a specific task that you need to get done, regardless of whatever the situation is. And then you're right, later on, when it comes time to process it, if you don't, obviously, then it's not going to go so well. But, you know, real men do cry. Yeah. Real men show emotion.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll go to more recent events. Actually, last weekend was I had to put my dog down. And this was a dog that I got in when I was in the Army, actually. So I've had her for a long time. And that was really emotional. Like, if that would have happened to me back then, I probably would have deflected and not had a problem. But I was very emotional. I'm still emotional to this day. Uh-huh. It was like a child. But yeah, real men, they cry.
Yeah.
They have to. If you aren't crying, if there isn't something that's made you cry, then you're not living, is what I would say. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want you to cry, and I don't want you to have to experience that, but you should be able to experience those emotions.
Yeah, absolutely. They say, you know, you can't
not hold it in.
You can't experience happiness until you experience sadness. You know, it's like,
yeah,
can't know one without the other.
Mm. So right. let's go back to, you know, now you've got the bodies and then we go into, you know, getting Marcus. So let's go into that a little bit.
Yeah. So at that point, you know, we just recovered all the bodies from the crash site, all 16, and it took us a while to find the all 16 bodies. And it was, I can't even put it into words how difficult it was to lug them up the side of a cliff and keep it together, so to speak. But we didn't even know Marcus was alive.
Yeah.
We knew that there was still a 4-man recon team that was missing. So, you know, every single hour that went by, we were obviously thinking, oh, there's no way they're alive. We haven't heard anything from them. And I think most of us in the back of our head expected them all to be deceased. At the same time, we still had the hope that we would find them because we knew that every single minute mattered. So, you know, every time we'd go out on a patrol, everything we did, we were moving at speeds that normally humans shouldn't move at with all the gear and stuff we had in a war zone. You shouldn't move that fast. It's not safe.
Yeah.
But we were moving as fast as we possibly could. Like I said, keeping up hope. We had the hope that that someone was going to be alive, but in the back of our heads, we really doubted it.
Mm. So now we see him. He's alive. So what was your thought process during that time? Like you just saw, you know, 19 other SEALs. You scraped them up off the floor of the hillside, and then you finally find a live soldier.
Yeah. So I was in a separate area. So I wasn't in the same actual area that Marcus was found. And I was on another side of the mountain. But we heard it over the radio.
The jackpot, right?
Yeah. It was like surreal that someone was alive. What? No way. Uh-huh. We found somebody? Somebody? All of them? One of them? Two of them? And, you know, none of us knew Marcus. You know, he was a stranger to us. We just knew that he was American. That's all that mattered. And I think this past year, that thought of, I don't care, he's an American, I feel like that's gone. Like, we're very divided. So writing this book this past year has been, I mean, a huge eye-opener for me. Like, wow, none of us cared whether he was, what service he was in, what race he was, what, I mean, we didn't care anything other than that's an American and we're going to get him.
Yeah.
And that's a feeling that I haven't had in a long time, but this past year, I felt like that's just like sucked out of us.
Mm-hmm.
We're focused on all these little things that make us different rather than the things that make us the same. Oh. And so I think this is a great story for this particular moment in time, because none of that mattered. Not a thing mattered. But hearing that Marcus was alive was, man, that we were all, you know, we hadn't eaten, we hadn't had any sleep in about, gosh, I think it was 3 days at that point. Mm-hmm. And almost four. So, you know, we were fatigued, but they talk about the shot of adrenaline you get when you hear that someone's alive.
Yeah.
So, I told that part of the story in my book from the perspective of a platoon leader in 2nd Ranger Battalion that actually wasn't my platoon leader, but he was a friend of mine. And he told me the story before he passed away. And so I've just kind of held on to that. And I've actually felt guilty about that, holding on to his story. Like, no one's ever told his part of the story. Mm-hmm. And he can't tell it. Mm-hmm. So part of the inspiration for writing this part of the story in the book was so his voice could be heard. Because as you know, all of us have a story in us, right?
Yeah.
And me being a private first class writing a book, I mean, try to find another war book written by the lowest man on the totem pole. There aren't any. It's usually like general or colonel or, you know, 30-year veteran. It's not the guy that did it for 4 years and then went on to become a doctor.
Mm. Like, let's start off at Oakmont High School.
Yeah, Oakmont High School. Normal, right? We did have Summer Sanders as a alumni.
Yeah.
She was like our shining light. She was just dominating at the time.
Yeah. So just take a few steps back again. There was one other thing I really wanted to hit on that really kind of hit deep when I was reading it. Back to when you were on the hill and finding the 16 seals. The story of the quest for the ring is what I'm going to call it. You kind of referenced Lord of the Rings throughout the book a few times, and then there was a body that was recovered, and you guys knew that he was recently married, and the ring was missing, and you guys were searching this mountainside for this man's wedding ring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a very... I think a victory is what I call it. Cause the whole mission, even though, Marcus survived, that was a huge victory, but overall the mission was a huge failure, right? We lost a lot of life.
Yeah.
And, so it's a depressing, sad, horrible story. Right. And this was one thing that happened on the mission that I thought was a huge win. And it was, you know, former West Pointer, you know, one of the best pitchers ever to come out of West Point. Actually, he's a baseball player, absolute stud, was recently married. And a lot of people knew him, so they told us that and said, you know, he always wears his wedding ring. He definitely should be there. So we need to find it. And we were combing through. I mean, I was on my hands and knees going through the burning rubble and ashes and dirt and mud and, you know, there was a huge fire there. So it was, you know, there was hot embers and things. We were just digging through and trying to find, and it took us hours, but we did. We finally, someone found that ring, and we were just jumping around for joy, celebrating. You know, just, I was so proud to know that widow had something, not what she wanted, not what we wanted to give her, but, it was something. And years later, I found her on actual Facebook, and I contacted her, and without, like, it was really awkward, obviously, right?
Yeah.
I didn't want to bring up any traumas, and I just kind of introduced myself and asked her if she ever received anything from the mission, and she goes, oh, you mean the ring? Like, yeah. And then she took a picture next to his picture with her ring on his ring on her hand.
Oh, wow.
And that was like, I mean, that was years later. That was only like 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But what a victory.
I mean,
I love that I got to tell that story.
Yeah. Amongst all that loss, you know, is grasp onto whatever you can, whatever small victory it is with, honestly, on a mountainside searching for a wedding ring and you guys found it. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was, I knew we would find it just because of the nature of all of us out there. We weren't going to leave until we did. But thinking back on it, I don't know how the heck we found that.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this huge Chinook reduced to this little ball of rubble and ashes and fire everywhere, and somehow we found that ring.
Wow. It's incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So now, you know, that whole operation happens and we bring Marcus home, the movie comes out and all that good stuff. You know, your life is still continuing. And, you know, you did 3 more years after that, and then you decide to get out. And now you're going back to school and whatnot. So walk us through the decision of leaving and why and whatnot.
Yeah, leaving was not easy, I'll tell you that. My heart was still there, but my body was failing me. It's a rough life being an airborne ranger.
Yeah.
The guys that do it for a long time, I'll tell you what, they are freaks of nature, and they won't admit it, but those guys are the toughest guys on the planet. You don't want to meet them in a dark alley, let's put it that way. So I knew that my body wasn't going to hold up. I was already beat up after 4 years. You know, I actually ended up in an orthopedic surgeon's office who told me I needed back surgery. And I wasn't willing to do it yet because I was too young and looking for options. And you know, I've tried everything. And my wife said, well, you haven't tried chiropractic. And I was against it. I'll be perfectly honest. I was totally against it. I said, I think I told her, I think my words were exactly, oh, they're not even real doctors. And after getting help and now becoming a chiropractor years later.
So are you a doctor? Are you a doctor?
I am a doctor. And not only that, is my training is up to par with a lot of other physicians as well. We don't get the pharmacology as much as they do, but everything else, it's up to par. Patients are still surprised by that because I think in the past, chiropractors were trained at, you know, level subpar to medical doctors, and it was significantly subpar. But nowadays, they're trained at a much higher level. And yeah, it's funny that I said that because obviously I have patients that think that too. So when I see it on their face, I'm like, I know what you're thinking. I've been there.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in the book, you talk about coming home for you is not quite compared to what it was like for a lot of people coming home for Vietnam. But, you know, you don't really, you get a lot of people who come up and say, you know, thank you for your service, but they don't really ask you how you lived. Do you feel like writing this book was a way of you getting what you wanted from people? Did whoever picks up this book and reads it?
Yes and no. I think, most of us that have served and who've done any, have been in combat, we don't really want to talk about it. You know, I will talk about it with my buddies if they want to talk about it, but it's not like something that I'm going to bring up in a conversation. Like, remember that one time we got in a firefight? Like, what purpose does that serve in my everyday life?
Yeah.
Everyone's going to be like, oh man, there's something wrong with this guy. You know, I mean, so this was kind of my way of telling my story without having that awkward moment where someone's like, and this happens all the time, have you ever killed anybody?
Yeah.
Well, I don't really want to put it like that. Mm-hmm. I can tell you lots of things about the military.
Yeah.
But to tell that, I mean, we're on here, what, 35 minutes, 45 minutes. And I've told you a little portion of my service.
Yeah.
Like, we're not even going into Ramadi, which was the next deployment, but this book was my way of kind of bridging the gap for, I think, all veterans. And I think a lot of people have a story in them, and it matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think until everyone's able to tell their story, we're going to have huge problems with PTSD, suicide, depression, because they're holding all this in. Holding it in forever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have any veterans in your families, I'm sure you probably do. What do you know about their service?
Not much.
Like, probably next to nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my grandfathers, both of them were in the Navy, and I know nothing about their service. One of them was in the Korean War, and I know absolutely nothing about it. So to me, that's a travesty. And that was my way of kind of, I don't know, encouraging the people around me, encouraging other soldiers, airmen, firefighters, police officers, tell your stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to go to the bar and scream it from the mountaintops, but put it down on paper.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, and you talk about PTSD, and this is a great segue into our next little bit here. You know, yourself, where is the relationship with PTSD in you? I mean, you know, you got your thoughts on paper. Is it getting better? Because I'm sure you have PTSD scraping people off of a mountainside. Absolutely. And all the other missions that you've gone on. So kind of speak to that a little bit.
I would say, the spectrum of PTSD is huge, right? So, for me, I was on the low end, I would say, but I think the reason I have been is because I've been, forthright and I've been holistic with my healthcare. I know that getting this out of my head is a great thing. I know that war sucks.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to pretend like it's amazing because it's not. Mm-hmm. Horrible. Mm-hmm. PTSD is one that I think a lot of people struggle with internally, and it holds them back in life. I think it holds them back big time because they're afraid of looking crazy or looking insensitive. But really, I think if everyone could just get their story out, even a part of it, that would lessen the burden on everybody. Civilians would understand more of what everyone's going through. And I say civilians, that's not to put anybody down. That's just a way to say that you haven't been to war. That's it. PTSD is definitely a thing that I want to bring more light to. I've been able to deal with it just because I have a fulfilling life, a great profession, and I've been very open-minded with it. Like, I know that in the back of deep part of my brain, there's trauma. Like, there has to be.
Yeah.
You cannot do this stuff without it. And recognizing that straight out of the gate is tough, first of all. You get, a high-performing individual, and you tell them, we need to admit that you have something wrong. Most people don't want to do that.
Mm-mm.
And especially in the spec ops community, those guys are hard. And I want more of them to be able to come out and say, hey, that sucked. That really sucked.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, you're not shy about it in your book at all. You're very clear that you have a love-hate relationship with war in itself. You know, talked about it. You're there for your brothers, and that's what pulls you and drives you through all of your missions and all the terrible things that you have to see. But, you know, at the same time, you don't enjoy it either, but you see it as necessary to protect our freedoms that we enjoy here.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think patriotism drove me to war, the love for country and love for fellow citizens. But once you get there, you realize, wow, this is horrible.
Yeah.
Like, part of you goes, why did I do this? Dr.
Brooks, we can sit here and talk for hours on all this stuff. However, we do have to kind of wrap things up here. So in wrapping it up, what message do you have to military personnel that you would like to share that you have not gotten a chance to kind of put it out there?
I would say a couple things. One is, I know you all have a story in you, and you have a great story, and it matters. You don't have to be a war hero. You don't have to be in a movie. I happened to be on a mission that was turned into a movie. Who cares, right? If it wasn't turned into a movie, no one would care. But it doesn't make my story insignificant. And I think a lot of soldiers and first responders out there should feel encouraged to tell their story. And that, I think that's the biggest message that I want to put across, is all of your stories are important. I want to hear them. Send them to me. You can email me. You can send me a message on Facebook or Instagram. I want to hear it. And I think if we all do that for each other and we listen to each other's stories, we're going to help everybody.
Yeah, that's the see how similar we all are.
Yeah.
You know, it might not have been the same experience, but the feeling is still the same.
Yeah, I mean, you guys weren't on Operation Red Wings, but a lot of the parallels you guys have experienced multiple times in your life. You even mentioned it. So you would have never known that parallel existed if I had not written this book.
Yeah,
absolutely. So I think we become more connected, and that was my goal, connection. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So with staying connected, we have a little rapid fire for you. You don't get off the hook. You don't get off the hook so quick. So you know, you've been in stressful situations. However, this is, I might be the top. It might be the top of stressfulness. So we have five questions. We have five questions for you. And you basically have to answer in one word or one phrase. That's all you get. All right. All right, Doc.
Whoa, this is tough. All right.
All right. Some are fun.
To me all day, every day.
Some are fun. Some are a little serious. So we'll see what you come up with. All right.
All right.
All right.
All right. First question. As a chiropractor, what is your least favorite adjustment to perform?
Least favorite adjustment. I mean, all of them are pretty awesome, but foot.
Foot adjustment.
Definitely the foot, because they're stinky.
Is there a character in any movie that you feel like you relate to the most?
This is an easy one. You guys know this one. Softball. Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump. That's right. Read the book. Read the book. All right, man. You got people holding up at a party that you're at, busting in with guns. And they say dance for your life. What is your go-to dance move?
I would go with the robot.
All right. All right. Okay. I like it. I like it. All right. If USC and the University of Arizona are playing each other, who are you rooting for since you went to both of those schools?
Oh, I'm going to have so many people getting at me for this one. What sport? Come on.
We're going to say basketball since I know that plays real near and dear to your heart.
Yeah, I'd say if it's basketball, my heart is in Arizona.
All right. If it's football?
Football is going to be USC.
Can't say we blame you much for that one.
Yeah.
All right. And last question. One word to describe your service as an Army Ranger.
That is not an easy one. I would just say selfless.
Mm.
I like it.
Absolutely. And guys, read that book. It's coming out in August, and we will definitely provide the link below, and you will see the selflessness that Dr. Brooks has when he goes and does his mission. So Dr. Brooks, again, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to get to know you over these past couple months trying to get this together. Yeah. I know we want to do it in person. Yeah. However, these COVID times, we have to do it over FaceTime. But the next one will definitely be in person, and we can't wait to have you again. Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Dr. Brooks, I don't know if you can see it.
I love it.
Here, you referenced Russell Wilson in the book. It was the only part that turned me off about the book was your reference to, I can't remember who you was, but here's
I am actually, shockingly, I am actually a 49er fan. But I would say this, Russell Wilson is one of my favorite players in the entire NFL. And that hurts because obviously he plays for our rival, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You could have used Joe Montana.
Yeah.
Joe Cool. You know what I mean?
I think last time I saw Joe Cool, I was, what, 10?
Yeah, I get it.
Well, all right, Dr. Brooks, thank you so much again for coming on. Yes. And we can't wait to have you on again, maybe after we release that book, or you release that book. And we'll kind of catch up back with you and see how things are going. So, again, thank you so much again. And this is Project Mayday. Call out.
Call out.